Mr. Bryant.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
I'm Neil Bryant. I'm the senator from Central Oregon, District 27. And before you is Senate Bill 1127, which I sponsored through the Judiciary Committee. And to give you some history, this is very similar to a bill that passed last session and took five or six licensing boards and made them semi-private. My motivation in doing that was sitting on Ways and Means and on the Emergency Board, and having these small licensing boards come to us and ask to hire a 0.25 employee, or to buy a Xerox machine, or to contract out something that right now they have to do through a state agency. And I asked LFO, how much does it cost to process one of these requests? Probably $1,000 by the time you send it to all the members and go through this. And then the time of the hearing, and then DOS has to review it. And it was sometimes more than what the request was involved. And it didn't make economic sense, nor policy sense, because these boards already make their decisions fairly independently. They just have to come to us for expenditure authorization. So, in conjunction with John Younger and DAF, we tried five or six last session. I believe it was the Board of Accountancy, and they're listed under Section 2 on page 2, the subsection 7, the Board of Trustees of the Children Trust Fund that was not in that group. And then I got periodic reports back during the interim from the different groups that were generally favorable. It was more work for them because they had to set them up themselves up to be a little different type of organization. But they enjoyed the independence, and they were happy that they had done it. There was one flaw in the prior legislation dealing with a required audit by Secretary of State, which is very expensive, and we have corrected that. So when we came to session this time, I took a list of the boards that were out there that I thought would be non-controversial and might consider this as a real benefit. Another reason to do this is it saves you money. You don't have to pay the 17% off the top to DAF for providing certain services and managing. And DOS doesn't feel bad about these boards even either, because they don't have the time or the expertise to really deal with these independent, semi-independent agencies. So that was, I took a look at the list, and I arbitrarily picked ones that I thought would be interested and that weren't controversial. For instance, one that's not here is the Board of Medical Examiners, because there's all these issues dealing with that. There were a few others. But the 15 that you see listed, and then number 7 under Section 2 of the Board of Trustees of Children's Trust Fund, were the ones I selected. I did this without asking.
Chipper Oregon. You can do that.
And because of the timing involved, I just went ahead and had the bill printed. I know you're going to hear from some today that said, gee, we'd really not like to participate in this. My intent is not to hold a gun to their head and say, you, they'll do this, that it would be voluntary. But as they hear the testimony, I would hope that they would reconsider, because it offers them more benefits than detriments. It's also, I think, better for their members, and also will save you and the Ways and Means Office time in the future as it relates to these types of things. There are the dash 1 amendments, which are just technical corrections, and the dash 2 come from the Board of Trustees of the Children's Trust Fund. This is a state agency that will operate better in raising money from the private sector if they're not viewed as a government agency. And the Ways and Means Committee Subcommittee on Human Resources, after hearing their budget request, said this is one that should go semi-independent, and that's why they're included in this. They think that they'll be able to raise considerably more money in this status as a strictly a state agency. So with that, I will stop and answer questions. Kathy, my extern, will be here to take notes and follow the discussion, and I appreciate you hearing the bill.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Susan Kochman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Klosterman. I'm Assistant Director for Communications with the Department of Administrative Services. And I'm here this afternoon just to bring you some information about what semi-independent means, and I'll keep it at a real high level. I realize there are a lot of people yet to speak on the subject. As Senator Bryant mentioned, there were five boards included in a pilot program from last session. And those boards are the Board of Architect Examiners, the Landscape Architect Board, the Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, the Board of Geologist Examiners, and the Board of Optometry. And I believe a few of those people, executive directors, are here to talk about their experience with you. Within these pilot boards, the pilot program, these boards are not subject to legislative or executive branch oversight, and they don't participate in the cost of central government either, so they don't have the DAS, central government charges. Some compensating controls that have put into place and put into place to offset that include public hearings processes, audits by the Secretary of State, and reports to the governor and to the legislative assembly. And the specifics of those reports are included in statute. The boards are exempt from a number of statutes that relate to most other state agencies. The primary differences between being semi-independent and being a standard state agency are in areas of budget and fee approval. These pilot boards don't require DAS or legislative review of their budgets or of their fee increases or fee changes. Also, their money is deposited in a bank rather than in the state treasury, and they're allowed to keep the interest on their money. The boards adopt their own personnel policies and procedures, and they set their own qualifications and compensation for staff. And they also adopt their own contracting and purchasing policies and procedures. One other difference is in the board membership. As a vacancy occurs for these boards in a non-public member position, an election is held, and then the outcome or the person who comes from that election, that name is given to the governor to approve. The public members of the board are elected by the members, the non-public members, and that list of names is submitted to the governor for approval. The boards also retain their authority to contract with other state agencies by mutual agreement. So if they wanted to contract with the Department of Administrative Services for accounting services, for example, they could do that. And they also retain their membership in the public employees retirement system, and they're eligible to receive all other benefits that other state employees do. A couple of things that may be included in amendments before you, I haven't seen those, but some of the things we've learned and suggestions for change. One of them, which is documented in other places, is the audit requirement in statute. The Division of Audits estimated that a cost per board per biennium would be between $50,000 and $100,000 as required by statute. So this was discussed at the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and there was an agreement that a certain portion, the performance portion of the audit, would become a self-assessment, and that's what's been done this first time around, and that is something we would like you to consider as a change in statute. Also, one of the concerns the executive appointment person in the governor's office has expressed and would like you to consider is the appointment of the board members. Right now, the governor approves a person, a proposed member, who is elected by the board. And although there hasn't been an issue, it could become quite controversial if a name is put forward and the governor doesn't approve it. And governor would like to be something other than a rubber stamp, of course. So that's also a concern by some of the boards who don't want to consider the idea of semi-independence right now. Their concern is that through the election process, the professional licensees could become a bigger part and may take over the board and not have that separateness that needs to be. So those are the two things we would like you to consider. One other thing I forgot to mention is that the pilot program, the board membership reappointments, is not addressed right now. The different boards address the reappointments in their rules, so that difference from board to board and is a little bit unclear.
That's from the five from the 95 session.
Right, correct. And I believe Senate Bill 1127 is modeled after that semi-independence definition. you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those as far as the role gas plays with some of my independent agencies.
Yes, thank you, Chair. A couple questions on the semi-private. Are there access, or are there any changes or opportunities for private funding for some of these agencies to go out and get money from private sector for operations as a result of semi-independent?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzger, that's an question that you could probably be better answered by one that has some experience in that. There's nothing to stop them from getting those kinds of money.
Okay. And then second question would be, how would when they contract for services, how does that differ from being a full state agency?
Right now, Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzger, the department staffs up to provide services to some small agencies that don't have the resources. What we've done with the pilot agencies is we had a 6-month transition period with them and then kind of encouraged them to go off on their own so that we could genuinely see whether or not they could operate more efficiently without central government. So right now we're not staffed up. We don't have the staff to provide services for them. And in fact, what we're saying is that we would give up half a position. Right now we're providing accounting services for only 8 of these that are included in the 22. And we would give up a half an accountant who's providing services to those agencies. And also we would give up 1 BAM analyst, budget and management division analyst, if all 22 became semi-independent. But once we gave up those positions, to answer your question, we would likely not have the resources to provide services, again, unless we asked for them and made a conscious decision to provide services. But they do continue, I believe, to receive services for mail and some of the standard things, perhaps telephone.
Okay. The size of these agencies, is there sort of a range?
I believe many of them, Mr. Chairman, are 1, 2, or 3 person shops. So we could provide you that information.
I guess the following question would be, what guarantee is there for protection of the people these agencies are supposed to be representing, or the rules and regulations are supposed to be enforcing?
Chairman, individuals with concerns can still approach the governor's office, and one of the reporting requirements is that each semi-independent report on number of complaints and actions taken on those complaints.
And is there any generalization you can make in the savings of these 22 agencies? I imagine they'd all be a little bit different, wouldn't they? But is there any general statement you can make about the amount that they would say? It's a 17% off the top from the DAS requirement.
We've done a fiscal impact, and the loss of revenue to the Department of Administrative Services, Mr. Chairman, would be around $200,000 for all of them. So that's a total.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you very much. Dave Plunkett, is that right? Dave Plunkett. Ed Graham and Jeannie Jeanette Bartel. Welcome. Who would like to start the day? Would you want to start this off?
Okay. Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is David Plunkett, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Optometry. I wasn't sure quite what would be covered by DAS, so I included in the handout an overview. That's been pretty well covered. And one thing I'd like to respond to was the assurances end of things. And as far as accountability, boards continue to be subject to public meetings laws and Administrative Procedures Act, just like before. Boards continue to be subject to state ethics law, Secretary of State audit, which still use the Attorney General's office. We still are under the tort liability coverage of the state. Budgets are adopted only after giving notices to licensees and holding a public hearing. Fees don't exceed the amounts necessary for carrying out board functions. And the board prepares annual financial statements, which we submit to DAS and are available for the public to see, as well as the report to send. We do a comprehensive report to the Legislative Assembly and the governor at the beginning of each session. Other than that, as far as the board's relationship to this body, it's exactly the same as it is or it was previously, except for the budgetary process. As a matter of fact, this group has been in the interim over here, I think, on three occasions before interim committee talking about this. So that's a little bit about accountability. As far as my purpose is to talk in support of 1127 as a board who has done this for going on 2 years now. And the other would be to entertain the -1 amendments, which then would allow these five boards to continue the semi-independent process. Essentially, what this bill does and what Senate Bill 546, which is the bill last session, does is to remove about 8 of the statutes that cover administrative procedures. And by removing them, we're able to operate more efficiently. For the Board of Optometry, and specifically, we were able to transfer some pre-Senate Bill 546 expenses and post-Senate Bill 546 revenues to support our operations. This amounted to approximately 7% of our $97.99 biennium budget. So, since we're a small board, approximately $329,000 biennium budget, that's not huge amounts of money, but 7% means a lot for a small board. For our board, we feel that since we've been able to save time and resources operating in this model, we would like to continue that. When Senate Bill 546 passed, this board didn't have any free staff time. But since 546, we've been able to assume all those responsibilities that previously other state agencies were doing with the same staff that we had. So we're doing it with the same staff, taking on the additional workload and saving that money. So we would like for you to consider passing Senate Bill 1127 and in particular the -1 amendment.
And the -1 to go to the pilot project. Thank you. Jeanette.
For the record, my name is Jeanette Bartel, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. The board would like to encourage your support for Senate Bill 1127. As you've already heard, Senate Bill 1127 is modeled after Senate Bill 546, which passed in the 1997 legislative session. The bill was basically, Senate Bill 546 was established as a pilot program to evaluate the practicality and cost efficiency of changing professional and occupational licensing boards to semi-independent status. The Oregon Board of Architects is one of 5 regulatory boards included in that program and was scheduled to sunset on June 30, 2001. Implementation of Senate Bill 546 has resulted in significant changes to the board operations. We now have increased control over matters involving personnel, purchasing, contracting, banking, and budgeting. With this control, however, comes increased reporting, notification, and hearing procedures in order to keep the public, registrants, and the legislature informed and involved. We have been semi-independent for almost 2 years now, and it was difficult at first, but it's getting better. There's a light now at the end of the tunnel, and we believe that the success of Senate Bill 546 is imminent. To this end, we would ask the committee to continue our semi-independence permanently through amendments to Senate Bill 1127.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Ed?
My name is Ed Gray. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, and my part in this is easy. I will echo the comments of others and entertain any questions. I can say that right now the Board of Engineering Examiners uses no services from DAS with the exception of the shuttle, and the shuttle we pay for independently for the benefit primarily of other state agencies that need to get information to us. We still cooperate closely with the Department of Water Resources, the Department of Transportation, Parks and Rec, and Building Codes, and there's a continuous flow of information back and forth, so the shuttle does facilitate that. Otherwise, we are totally semi-independent. We have our own telephone system, our own computer system, our own internet site, and we are completely enthralled with the whole idea. We have been extremely pleased with the process, and as Jeanette pointed out, it was difficult at first, mostly in communicating to those vendors who are unfamiliar with the process to continue services that we'd expect to receive. Other than that, once the communication was resolved, things are going well. I did have one question in the Dash 1 amendments. I have no idea where they came, from whence they came, but the bill requires investment of our funds in a federally insured program. I also called for a fully collateralized reserve, and we have followed that to the letter. However, we did not invest in the state pool. We have collateralized reserves beyond that, and the interest rate was better. So I'm not certain of why the manner consistent is being replaced by accordance, which means we would then have to use the investment pool. That was just a question. I have no idea more.
Sherry, do you have any idea? Peter, what part of Dash 1 does that have?
It's on page 2. There's nothing. Line 31. It refers to line 27 in the deal.
You think an accordance has a different meaning than manner consistent?
Senator Milton, that's the way our board interpreted the in accordance or manner consistent, because we were criticized for not using the state investment pool. However, our investments are in a manner consistent with that investment. It is fully collateralized according to the bill.
So you don't think it has to be changed because you're...
Well, that's our position, at least.
Okay.
It's not a critical issue, however.
The legal terms, accord and satisfaction or something, but we're not talking about that. Check my legal counsel. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. So there, we've called. Karen DiLorenzo and Joan Bone, is that right? Joanne, excuse me. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Karen DiLorenzo. I'm the administrator of the State Board of Accountancy.
And Mr. Chair, I'm Joanne Bones, the Executive Director of Fortune.
Our purpose here is not necessarily to throw cold water on David Ed and the Architects Board's testimony, but just to explain to the committee our caution. We're one of the boards that has asked to be removed from the bill. As Senator Bryant stated earlier, it was kind of a surprise to us to be put in the bill in the first place. And I represent a profession that has a reputation, I believe, for being cautious and conservative, and that reputation prompted them to agree with most of the testimony sort of against the bill right now that Joanne will give you. But they also, like several of the other boards who asked to be removed, remain supportive and interested in the pilot project. The pilot project, as you know, was started last session and was scheduled to go for 4 years. That's two biennia. excuse me, they've been watching it. We've been listening to the testimony through small agency meetings and public meetings. We are co-located in the same building with David Plunkett and have watched his success and elation with the bill. Excuse me. That the board is interested in any kind of interim study that might come up to allow us to make changes in a little slower manner, a more cautious manner, and to look at some of the underlying issues so that we're sure that we're all on the same boat. One of the things that has benefited us greatly as a board in the last 4 or 5 years now has been co-located with 7 other licensing boards. And I think in moving forward on a bill like this, we would like to look at some kind of a centralized, at least sharing a consultant to help get us set up in some kind of a new situation, and also perhaps sharing an office manager type position among the boards that are co-located to help us run these administrative functions separately from the state. So those are the kind of issues that we're concerned about, and I think some of the other boards are concerned about right now.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, thank you. The Board of Dentistry reviewed this legislation on Friday the 9th and voted to request to be removed from the bill. The board's primary concerns are that, as Mr. Plunkett and Jeanette pointed out, it does significantly increase the board and the staff's workload for at least a year, and we do not see that we have that excess staffing or time to devote to those issues at this time, though we're still very supportive of the pilot project. Currently, the board spends about $25,000 a year out of a $700,000 per year budget for the accounting, payment of bills, payroll, audit, preparation of financial reports, personnel and labor relations advice, the expert advice we receive from Information Systems Resource Management, and we just don't see how we can replace those services for that price. In addition, the board's also concerned about the prospect of removing further legislative and executive branch oversight from the board may give consumers the perception that the board would be more under the control of licensees and not there for the protection of the public. This may not be valid concern, but the that perception exists already that licensees are regulating licensees, and we want to be very careful that the consumer protection role of the board remains intact. The board is satisfied that the existing reporting and oversight structures are adequate, that they provide appropriate balance, and at the same time, it's cost-effective and responsive to the needs of consumers. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Do the DAS 1 to DAS 2 affect your status in any way? Do they say that you are to be removed or can be removed? They don't. They do not. Okay. I'm just checking. So you don't,
you're not allowed. Looks like DAS 2s affect the children's trust fund.
Oh, that's right.
Receive them from me.
And the DAS 1 to go to the pilot program. Okay. Very good. So just checking. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Van Thompson. Is it Bev Holtzman? Hello. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Senator Nelson and members of the subcommittee. I'm Deb Holdman, the Executive Director for the Board of Massage Technicians. I won't take a lot of time. I have spent time with some members of the boards in the pilot program, and the Board of Massage is in favor of Senate Bill 1127 and would like to remain in that bill. We do not wish to be pulled out of that panel.
Okay. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Leanne Thompson. I'm Executive Officer for the Board of Radiologic Technology, and I've provided the committee with some testimony. In short, we too would like to remain in the bill, thinking it provides the best use of our time and resources.
Okay. Good question. Thank you very much. Well, that was good testimony.
Good.
Jackie.
Navicky
and Cindy Thompson.
Members of the committee, my name is Cindy Thompson. I'm Executive Director of the Children's Trust Fund. And with me today is Jacqueline Babicki, who is Chair of our Fundraising and our Finance Committee. We're here to testify in support of the Senate Bill 1127.
Okay, Senator Nelson, the committee, thank you for having me today. I'm Jackie Babicki. As Cindy said, I'm a trustee of the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. We want to stay in Senate Bill 1127, but we are not a regulatory board, as most people you've been hearing are today. The Children's Trust Fund is kind of an unusual organization. We were created by the legislature in 1985 to find ways to prevent primary prevention of child abuse in Oregon. And we're an interesting organization in that we have two distinct funds that we operate. One is the Children's Trust Fund, which is a 501c3. And through that trust fund, we are able to raise money. We get money from the income tax checkoff. We have a portion of the sale of heirloom birth certificates. We get some funding from the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. And in addition to that, we're in a series of public employee campaign funds and individual or public fundraising that we do. And all of those funds go to support grants for organizations throughout the state that are dedicated to the prevention of child abuse. And the reason that we can make those grants, it was 100% of that money, is that our operations, our administrative, is supported through a second fund that we have, which is called the Endowment Fund. And that was created for us in the 1995 legislative session. And the Endowment Fund is funded for us through a fractional percentage of the criminal fines and assessment account. And we're a very, very small agency. We only have 1.5 full-time people. One senior, our executive director, and another half-time person who's an administrator. And because of the size of our agency, and yet there is no, de minimis in statutes for what an agency has to do, we find it quite time-consuming and inefficient to operate, under all of the state requirements for an agency such as we are. We do have our 1.5 full-time people, and then there's, a 12-member volunteer board of directors. And out of that board, we do a lot of fundraising, and we have a, the grant program that we do. And we're very eager to move along the road to privatizing the Children's Trust Fund, being that we see some opportunities for some great efficiencies in the way that we operate. First of all, not having to work through a very arduous budget process for such a small organization, not having to work with board requirements, when we get money that has been donated to us and it wasn't in our budget, and so we have to work through the e-board to get the opportunity to increase our grants to the agencies. It will also help us to solicit more funds from the public, being that there's kind of a stigma attached with a lot of people who say, now,
how can we be making donations to state agencies? We're not going to, we don't want to do, gifts and that sort of an organization. And by the time we finish explaining it, we've lost their attention and certainly their donation. So we are, as I say, very eager to remain part of Senate Bill 1127 and move along and in several steps to total privatization.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
We have a series of folks here signed up against it. Ed Patterson, Barbara Orazio, Peggy Smith, Elaine Hammond, Beth Darby, that's correct, and Bob Anderson. If you feel the real compelling need to come up and testify, I mean, I understand that you're against it, and if you're not either for or against the bill, you just want to stay out of it, I guess we would note that for the record. And we'll have to make some sort of provision here because we don't want to force people into this thing, I guess, unless we make some sort of discussion on it. But if you wish to come up, please come up at this point.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee. My name is Beth M. Darby. I'm the executive director of the Board of Psychologist Examiners, and I just want to share with you the Board of Psychologist Examiners' three concerns that they have with this bill. Otherwise, they're quite supportive of it. The first one is they're very concerned about the electoral process that's involved in selection of its members, and they would appreciate being a part of this if that were change to retain the current process for board members. The second item is that they are still unsure about the cost and what potential gains may be associated with the fiscal part of this as well. And then the third thing is they would like some more opportunity to discuss what kinds of opportunities there are for contracting out certain services that the current staff would not be able to perform. But I just wanted to share with you quickly there. Three main areas of interest, and they would appreciate two more years to study what the other agencies are doing in regards to those issues.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's little that I have to add that has not been said already. I'm Peggy Smith, and I'm the executive officer to the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, but do want it on record that our board would like to opt out at this point, and we are interested in being involved in an interim task force if there is one selected. Thank you very much.
I'm Barbara Orazio with the Board of Examiners and Nursing Home Administrators, and I would just like to echo Peggy Smith's remarks. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for being such a gentleman. Okay. Introduce yourself, sir. He's going to...
Okay. I'm Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Anderson. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm not an executive director. So I have a little different viewpoint of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board. We are a relatively small board, and we feel like we're very busy as a board. We keep busy all the time. And one of our problems with this is, again, how much responsibility will go on the board and members themselves. It looks to me like we have administrative duties now as well as the other duties that we were elected for. And we're wondering if the people who currently were elected for the board will understand the job that they have now, because we were not elected to do the administrative work and the things that I think that this bill does. We would like to opt out of the bill, but we are very interested in it. I think it's a good concept. As a citizen, that we should do these things, but I think the administration of it will be very difficult. The other issue that our board has is that whether or not the public remains protected, and we heard some things for it, but we really wonder if these boards can get loaded, so to speak, when there are monies coming from other private organizations and such, and what that will do. We in veterinary medicine, for example, have corporate medicine coming for the first time into our ranks, and we don't know that effect would have on these kinds of semi-private boards. So I think our main thing is we're very interested in it, but we would like to opt out at this time.
Good afternoon, Senator Nelson and members of the committee. I'm Elaine Hamm. I'm the interim executive director of the board.
established in 1997 and are really trying to get our feet on the ground yet. We're not having a administrative difficulty. We're really worried about starting over and having to reestablish a bunch of policies. We also have a unique situation. I'm an interim director. The interim director is going to return after medical leave, starting probably in June, and personally, given that we are a one further putting the ability of the licensees to vote on the budget and fees and so forth. About certain audits and certain procedures and reports and policies
that we have to do. Thank you very much. Jim Davis. Do you also back here, Jim Davis? Yeah. If Ed wants to talk sometimes, the hammer. Jim, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Jim Davis, representing State Council of Senior Citizens and the United Seniors of Oregon and the Oregon State Insurance Association. We wanted to express our serious concerns about 1127. We have some general concerns about whether such a move to more independence would potentially affect these boards' accountability to consumers, to the public, to the state government, and to the legislature. Could self-interest become more prominent and public and consumer interest become less of a priority is one question we're asking. A good example to us is the Board of Dentistry, who have ignored consumer and senior input in their continued attacks on the denturist profession. And we feel that, you know, and this is a story I will not go into a lot of detail, but a board like the dental board certainly needs more accountability to the public and certainly not less. Finally, we are concerned about the effects on the State Board of Denture Technology, who are currently in a very efficient situation as part of the Health Division licensing program, which encompasses nine different boards with shared staff, office, computer systems, complaint and investigation processes. If this bill went through and the Board of Denture Technology remained on it, fees would likely have to double, and the budget would increase from $83,000 to $222,000. Of course, there are only around 120 licensed insurers in the state of Oregon. So we would ask that that the Board of Denture Technology be removed from 1127, since at this point we do not see the benefits to the denturist profession of making this change.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Ed Patterson. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And, Mr. Chair, my comments will be directed to the boards that are health care in nature for human care as opposed to animal care or other types of care and the other types of health professions, the other types of licensing professions. Our main concern is the health care workforce because, in fact, hospitals hire a significant number of the health professional licensees. In some cases, some of the professionals we hire, 90% of them work in hospitals as technicians. And others, we have contractual relationships with many of the physicians, with some of the other health professionals, and of course, we're the biggest employer of nurses. So we think there's a good argument to make that health professionals should be separated from an effort like this to privatize some of the other licensing boards. For your reference, Mr. Chair, I've enclosed a copy of my testimony, which I don't intend to read. I just want to make a few points off of it. I've also enclosed a couple of forms in the back of my testimony from the Pew Health Professions Commission. I just want to familiarize this committee with this commission. This commission is 10 years old, was funded as an effort from the Pew Family Trust, which is an Eastern organization that has lots of money and provided money to the University of California to staff this trust. They had basically two phases. The first phase that they went through and completed in 1995, and then published a document, it's a yellow one here, and that was a preliminary look at the healthcare workforce regulations, i.e. licensure boards. And I just want, on the second page, on the back of the second page, I want to read to you their principles, and I think it gives a good background on what these folks looked at. One, promoting effective health outcomes and protecting the public from harm. Two, holding regulatory bodies accountable to the public. Three, respecting consumers' rights to choose their health care providers from a range of safe options. Four, encouraging a flexible, rational, and cost-effective health care system which allows effective working relationships among all health care providers. And the last one, facilitating professional and geographic mobility of competent providers. And if you'd like to look at the back page, you can see the members of this, next to the back page. This first commission that was appointed was chaired by former Governor Lamb from Colorado, as a very prestigious number of people in the commission, and appointed a special task force to look at just the healthcare workforce regulations. The second report, which was completed in 1998, is the white copy that looks like this. They go into more details and kind of look more focused just at the healthcare workforce regulations. And again, it was a very prestigious committee to look at this. United States Senator George Mitchell chaired the group, and a number of very notable persons who served on the group, some politicians, some mostly academics in terms of healthcare, including providers and consumers. So I point this out, we have the complete studies, by the way, these are only summaries of them, but we have looked at these long and hard because we've been involved in health professional licensing issues in the legislature for many, many years. I'm going to cover also attached in your the handout that I provided for you is a sheet of paper that says 10 regulatory reform issues addressed. Just briefly, I would like to bring your attention to these because I think they are relevant in terms of what 1127 is attempting to do. The first one is a September 1995 report, and they make recommendations on standard terms and language. They found that there were a variety of standards, there were no standards, but a variety of terms that were inconsistent not only between the states, but also within the states, and we had some of that same problem in Oregon. Standards for entry to practice. Entry to practice is a key issue. If healthcare licensing boards have too much autonomy, the potential for limiting access to that profession may become a real problem. Scope of practice and titles issue. In Oregon, as an example, we co-mingle the use of license certified and registered. And they commingle of all the health professions. They're meaningless in the state of Oregon because of the way that the statutes have been developed. Scope of practice issues, if any of you have been here more than a session or two, if Senator Byers is nodding, he understands those kinds of issues that we have looked at. Every year there's a scope of practice fight, and Senator Starr remembers well from the Health Committee session ago. These are issues that are concerned nationally. The federal government has basically abdicated any responsibilities for this in the past and has left licensure up to the states to handle. And that's why we have the big variance. Continuing competence is always a concern of ours, and one of the things we want from the state is to guarantee some competency level of our licensees. How each board handles complaints and discipline, it varies. The more autonomy, the more it's going to vary. And, of course, the evaluating of the effectiveness. The next page there was his 10 final recommendations, or the 1998 recommendations, and you'll see if you briefly read over those, they basically were in a mode to provide some national standards. Well, the reality is that the way state laws have developed, becoming nationalizing some of these standards is going to be an impossibility. It may take place on the next generation sometime, but the reality is it's probably not going to take place on a national level, although the seeds have been planted through this report. The next to the last bullet down there says, prior to adoption of national standards, states should explore, develop evolutions of scope of practice. And I think these are the kinds of things that we need to look at individually as healthcare private licensing boards. But probably these recommendations are not going to be addressed by the feds for a long, long time. Let me cover my testimony in terms of this one sheet where I say it's an overview of the current Oregon's health care provider licensing system. Mr. Chair, in my testimony, it's spelled out in more detail, but I just wanted to highlight some of the concerns we have. For one thing, as I indicated, hospitals and health systems do hire most of the health care professionals. If they don't hire them, in the case, as an example, of radiological technologists, 90% of those individuals work in hospitals or health systems, and there is a certain expectation that human resources people within hospital health systems need to have about the quality and the caliber of those individuals. And so we think that total autonomy, and you can call it independence or part independence or whatever you want, basically this grants these boards an extreme amount of autonomy. And we think that those licensees, the state has an obligation to make sure those licensees have a certain competency level, and that concerns us. The laws have been created over the past have become a hodgepodge. As I indicated briefly, the titles are commingling. I think it creates confusion to the public, whether a licensed person and a certified person or a registered person means one and the same, or whether it doesn't. And the reality is that we have almost every legislative session a certain group who will come and lobby for licensure capability for one word, one reason or the other. And usually what I've found over the years of experience has been that you'll get some of the more militant, strong-feeling licensees who want to create a licensing board. They'll come down and lobby the legislature, represent to the legislature that there are benefits to all of the persons in that profession. They get back, and if you check out in the grassroots, they don't have consensus among their own professions even that they want to be licensed, and they boil down to having to pay $100 or $150 or $200 a year for the privilege of licensure. There is no consensus that that's what the real desire is. And unfortunately, this doesn't happen all the time, but more cases than not, and has happened, that the profession itself is not the one seeking licensure, but the legislature believes they are, and therefore grants the authority of a licensing board. We feel very strongly that, and this applies to all licensing boards, not just health professional licensing boards, but in essence what the state does is grant a franchise to those individuals. And the state says that we grant licensure status, the state grants licensure status to this profession, and therefore they can hold themselves out as the only one that can practice that profession. And the state endorses that, in essence grants a franchise. Well, the public has a right to have some expectation about the level of competency of those individuals, because they're working under the umbrella and the authority of the state. So we think that 1127 is an example, and the previous bill is another example from last session, are really moving in the wrong direction, the opposite direction, and particularly as it applies to health professions, as the Pew Commission has indicated. Nothing the Pew Commission supports or identifies a need for autonomy among these boards. More than anything else, it says you should work with more regulations than less. So we think the idea of the state granting a franchise brings with it some state obligations for oversight that autonomy certainly doesn't provide. Scope of practice issues currently are resolved in the political environment of the legislature. They always are. In more cases than not, whoever has the most political muscle usually wins those fights. And we think that there are better ways to do that on a scientific basis, and that these boards need to get together and appoint some highly technical group to look at if there's disputes between boards, to look at these issues and decide who is the best qualified, who is the best trained, or maybe they are equally as well trained, and two different professions could provide the same or virtually the same type of service. We think those are important issues that will never happen if we grant autonomy to these boards. And lastly, Mr. Chair, we are really concerned, and we were concerned last legislative session when we testified against Senate Bill 546 for these very reasons, that this political momentum, this legislative momentum, is going to create more and more desire for all boards, regardless of whether health professional boards or whether there are other types of licensing boards, for this autonomy. And where it might be feasible and desirable for licensing boards to be autonomous, it brings a whole other area of problems that we've even seen in the past with some licensing boards. They seem to run in cycles where one board becomes so controlled by the group that is frightened by. They're intimidated and sometimes coerced in providing special considerations for people who want to be in licensed by that board but don't belong to the right organization to become licensed. They become a good old boys club. The question Senator Metzger brought up raises big concerns about outside funding. In some cases, I have seen where some of the executive directors of these boards have begun to act more like professional association execs than licensing board execs. And this type of blending of responsibilities can lead to a lot of chaos if we expect the state to guarantee certain levels of competency and levels of discipline for the licensees. So we request, Mr. Chair, that if you proceed with this bill, that the five licensure boards that are healthcare licensing boards would be excluded from the bill, and that recognize that the healthcare professions are unique in the types of patients and services they provide in this state and need more regulation, not less. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Bill Craw.
There are in this section, but I listed them in my fifth one, the Board of Clinical Social Workers, the Board of Examiners of Licensed Dietitians, the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, and the Board of Radiologic Technology.
Further questions? Bill Clark. It doesn't say
you're
for or against, so we have to
find out
where you're at here.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and we are supportive of the portion that would include the Landscape Contractors Board in the new status of semi-independent status. The Landscape Contractors Association works very closely with the Landscape Contractors Board. I am not, however, speaking on behalf of the Licensed Contractors Board, but the industry itself believes that providing this type of status for the Licensed Landscape Contractors Board would be a good step. They do work very closely, and in fact, the board receives its management and support from the Construction Contractors Board, but that board, the total number of contractors represents, I believe, about 96% of the contractors. So the Landscape Contractors Board sort of gets lost sometimes. There's a lot of common functions, and I think there's some natural alliances there, but there are also some needs for the landscape industry to have maybe its own greater awareness, its own enforcement and compliance with its licensure laws. So this may offer at least some opportunities to look at some different arrangements or some special contracts with individuals who could help provide some unique educational opportunities, for example. So we would support being considered in the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Are you aware of the Dash 1 amendments? Do you represent one of the boards that are involved with that Dash 1 amendments?
I only heard them discussed. I'm not aware of them, but I'll
okay. Add to further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I think everybody's got an opportunity to testify. Sure, yes. Please, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafoy. I'm here representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Board. Actually, not the board itself. I'm representing the Professional Association, the Physical Therapy Association, but they asked me if I would make some comments on behalf of their staff to talk to the board members. I represent two professions presently whose licensing boards are semi-autonomous, the Board of Architects and the Engineering Surveying Board. They represent the surveyors and represent the architect. And I found a couple of things about the law that has worked so far. First, it takes a while for the benefits to show up.
we shouldn't expect that, that immediately after this passes, all of a sudden things are going to change. It really is a very big sea change in the way the boards operate. But eventually what we're starting to see is that the boards are realizing that with their autonomy and their ability to develop their own budgets, they can really set out and do the things that they think is important to do, spend their time on regulating the profession and hiring investigators and getting after the discipline problems. Unfortunately, what we've seen too much is these boards are spend so much of their time, especially executive directors who are overworked, filling requirements of the legislature. The budget process is a long, difficult process. It requires going through a number of steps and hoops. It takes a whole lot of time. And at the end of it, you get into the legislature, and the legislature wants to know how many pencils did you buy this month and how many pieces of paper did you buy this month, instead of asking questions about what is the policy of your board and are you really achieving that. I think once we eliminate that requirement to go to the board, to go to the legislature for that kind of excessive oversight, budgetary oversight, we're going to find our boards are having more time and more flexibility and changing their orientation towards regulations. I have not seen the slightest bit of a feeling of being captured by the professional association. Once people leave the professional association and go to these roles in the board, they change their position. They change their attitude. In fact, sometimes it's a little too much for us. We have some difficulties still with not harsh conflicts, but differences of opinion between the professional association and the board. And I think these people take their roles very seriously as being protectors of the public and representing the public, and I've not seen at all any evidence that they're captured by the professional associations. And really, most of these people come out of the professional associations. That's how they get appointed in the first place. Historically, it's been the associations that made mention to the governor, here's the person who's worked for years in the association, probably be a good board member. So these people traditionally have come out of that. And I don't think historically we've seen where that's led to a problem. So I would support the bill very strongly. And my experience has been good, and I think it's, we can do more good in the future.
Okay, so you're going to want the sunset removed.
Mr. Chair, I don't care one way or another. That's probably a good idea.
Yeah, okay.
Questions?
Thank you very much. No further testimony. We will close the public hearing. Oops. Okay. We'll reopen hearing. Please step forward.
And very quickly, I'm Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. We did want to let you know that at this time we tentatively support including the Board of Dentistry in the bill. And I guess we want to say that our support is based on a rather small sample of our leadership, and this week is our annual meeting, and we hope to get a broader sample. And I did want to point out that the Board of Dentistry, at least, and I think some of the other healthcare boards, are entirely supported by fees from licensees. There's no general fund or tax money in the Board of Dentistry's budget. And we also would support Mr. Davis's statement for the Oregon State Denturist Association and the United Senior and other senior groups to exclude the State Board of Denture Technology from the bill. And we see they have a rather small board, a small number of licensees, and we are still trying to iron out some problems that have come up about the board's work. So with that, I'll close my
testimony. Okay, thank you. Your name was on there. I just missed it. Any further testimony? Close public hearing. And we will go into work session. We do have so much to do with this, but we'll have to keep some things. Open public hearing on FTR 3, Julie Curtis and Chet Orloff. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Senator Nelson and committee members, I'm Julie Curtis. I'm currently on loan from the Tourism Commission as a half-time manager of the Oregon Heritage Commission. That's who I'm representing today. And I'm here today to express support for SCR 3, which would declare support for the upcoming Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. As you might know, the Heritage Commission has statutory authority or responsibility for overseeing all statewide anniversary celebrations. So we are very involved in Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Planning. We're very closely with OHS and others in this. I brought a handout for you today that shows the many organizations that are involved in the Lewis and Clark planning. It's diverse from historical societies to the Oregon Historical Society, Indian tribes, tourism organizations. There are many, many people across the state that are very involved and very excited about this upcoming commemoration and bicentennial. What I'd like to draw your attention to today is the necessity of having state seed money for planning the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. Oregon is the only state, I believe, among 11 states that to date has not received state funds for coordinating our bicentennial planning. And the Heritage Commission currently has $100,000 for Lewis and Clark planning in our governor's recommended budget. Our budget is in the state parks budget, which is under Senator Hannon's subcommittee in Ways and Means on Transportation and Economic Development. While I know you don't approve budgets in this committee, for us, I did want to bring it to your attention that this seed money for planning is essential. We know from the Oregon Trail sesquicentennial that we celebrated in 1993, it takes a lot of organization, a lot of individuals, it takes paid staff to pull off something as big and as important, certainly as a bicentennial. All of the efforts to date have been voluntary. Mr. Orloff, who will speak later, his staff, the tourism staff, the Heritage Commission staff, Fort Clatsop, a variety of people have been very involved in donating their staff time and resources, but we really do need that state seed money so that we can move that money out to a nonprofit to start raising money from the private sector and matching that. Just in closing, the Oregon Trail Coordinating Council received $1.5 million from the state legislature in 91, probably. They were able to at least raise $20 million in private and other funds to leverage that state money. So we are very excited about planning for the bicentennial. We are very supportive of what you're proposing here to endorse the commemoration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Chet Orloff. I'm the director of the Oregon Historical Society and secretary of the Oregon Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in Oregon. In 1903, your colleagues in this legislature appropriated $300,000 to help develop commemoration for the centennial celebration of 1905-1906. That celebration is still at the end of this, at the end of the century now, considered one of the most important economic development factors in this century still. And because we brought more than 1 million people to Oregon, 1905, before there was any, there were any paved roads in and out of the state, there was no direct air routes, there was no direct railroad, and shipping was rather slow. Yet we managed to build on that, and within 10 years following the 1905 centennial, the state had grown by more than 70% in direct relationship to the number of people who were brought to the state. I'm not saying that that can happen again or that we want it to happen again. I think that is an important point to make. Nevertheless, we have an excellent educational opportunity. It's 2005 in terms of using the spine, if you will, of Lewis and Clark, the expedition, and the bicentennial to educate Oregonians, particularly younger ones, about the issues of science, exploration, innovation, history, that are all tied to this bicentennial. And we have a large federal and national effort that has begun. I have just recently served a term as the president of the National Bicentennial Council. And tomorrow, day after tomorrow, we bring to Oregon and Washington 250 representatives from around the nation who will meet here to begin planning the bicentennial. And I would hope that we would take this legislation, SCR 3, and begin to formally acknowledge the bicentennial and begin to support it at the state level. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Just a proposed amendment here with all this. Do you know anything about those? What's that?
Mr. Chair, you have two amendments, SCR-2-1 and SCR-2-2. What we want to look at is the -2 amendment, which incorporates contents of dash 1 plus a final change, which is in line 13 on the dash 2, which says delete the word celebrate and insert the word commemorate. And this change is based on the input from representatives of Native American tribes. They see the Lewis and Clark bicentennial events as something for us to remember, but not necessarily to celebrate. At least in order for us to make it a more inclusive effort, including representation from the Native tribes, we have gone through the bill and make a change appropriately. The above portion, lines 3 through 10, in the dash 2 amendment, which is really done in order to highlight the work of the Oregon Historical Society and speak to organizations that are involved in the bicentennial celebration or commemoration in a way that's a little bit more inclusive and explicit. That's it.
Okay. Do you have any comments on the proposed amendment? And I'll move for the testimony. I saw something up close to the hearing. Go into a work session, and we're looking at the dash 2 amendments. Is that correct? Chair would move the dash 2 amendments to SCR 3. Any comments? Objections? The orders? The chair would move SCR 3 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Ta-da. Chair will carry it. My whistle.
Your bill.
My bill. I'll take care of that.
All right. A couple of minute home bills for you.
What are we doing here? Let's see. Now we're opening public hearings on Senate bills 1049, 157, and 159. It's called Dave Effort. Eford, Karen DiLorenzo, and Les Fordham. Yeah. We've gone from... I've got to go next door. I'm sharing. I'll be next door. I'm going to
go next door. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Eford. I'm the past chair of the Oregon Board of Accountancy and currently serve as a legislative liaison for that board. With me here is Karen DiLorenzo, the administrator for the State Board of Accountancy. With your indulgence, I would like to speak to three bills that are before you today and answer questions about them to the extent that I can. First is Senate Bill 1049. As a board policy, the State Board of Accountancy has decided to adhere to the Uniform Accountancy Act wherever possible and when consistent with our intent here in the state. And as we have discussed before, across the United States, there is a great transfer between the states, across jurisdictional lines, and internationally as well. Among members and licensees of the accounting profession, and we find that it is helpful, convenient, and sometimes required to have uniformity of laws across all those jurisdictional lines. So we have been working with the Oregon Society of CPAs to bring uniform accountancy laws into the Oregon state accounting laws, and on this particular bill we've been working with them for over a year. In the form of joint committees between the Board of Accountancy and the CPA Society, and as well holding discussions about specific provisions of the bill, which we would like to see adopted at our board meetings, which are open board meetings, and our work sessions that are attended by all of our constituent organizations, including the OSCPA and the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. We also spent considerable time last fall going around the state holding a series of town hall meetings where we invited all of the licensees and other constituent and interested parties to come to those town hall meetings and discuss this provision with us, as well as the Board of Accountancy's provisions, which we have discussed seven of in a previous hearing, and we'll discuss two more today. The legislation, as it presently stands with friendly amendments agreed upon by both the board and the Society of CPAs, we believe will bring the state of Oregon into substantial equivalency in its accounting laws with the Uniform Accountancy Act and with the numerous other states which have adopted these provisions. We believe that this law and the provisions within this law that are specific to the state of Oregon will allow us to regulate what has become a quickly changing profession, one that whose licensees offer an expanded list of services well beyond the traditional tax and accounting services that older laws were designed to look at and to regulate. We believe that because of these expanded services, there are some needs and there are some actual practices going on in the changes in the way that accountants are compensated, and we need to deal with that. And specifically, I'm talking about commissions and contingent fees. We believe that there is a need for an expansion in the types of business organizations where accountants can practice and hold themselves out as accountants. And specifically, current laws that require accounting firms to be owned only by licensed CPAs, if they call themselves a CPA firm, could be modified to reflect the fact that accountants practice in conjunction with other people, other professionals that offer other services, including insurance and financial planning and other things that might require those other professionals to have ownership within the firm with the CPA. And again, just the international aspects of business and finance that we face today do require us to maintain uniform laws with the other jurisdictions where our licensees practice and where licensees from other jurisdictions come into our state to practice. We do have a number of elements of this Uniform Accountancy Act already in place in the state of Oregon, and what this bill will do will really implement the remaining portions of the Uniform Accountancy Act that we think we need in the state to complete our match with the other jurisdictions and make our laws equivalent to the other states. I would point out that we have been monitoring changes that have been made by the national institutions. We belong to the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, and we work through that association with the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. And there have been some strong moves to make changes like the ones that we're asking for here, particularly for types of compensation for accountants that I mentioned and for ownership of firms. And our provisions are really following the provisions that have been enacted in a majority of other states in the country already. We have confirmed with the constituent organizations in the state where our licensees and other accounting professionals hold membership that they're supportive of this bill, and we believe that the provisions are effective for what we want to do, and we would ask the committee members to pass this bill on to the full Senate for its approval.
Thank you. Questions or amendments? Okay, moving on. Karen, did you? Well, and Wes?
Senator Beyer, did you want to cover the other two bills that are Board of Accountancy specific at this point?
Probably. They're already included in there? There's something additional about the other two that you want to cover?
Well, let me just explain, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. The Board of Accountancy, because it has to file its legislative concepts well in advance of the session, put in place two provisions. Those are represented by Senate Bill 157 and Senate Bill 159 that are also elements of Senate Bill 1049. Those two provisions we put in place because we feel we must have some action on those two portions in order for us to accomplish the work that we're doing now to deal with some of the issues that we've already run up against. Those, in our mind, are place savers, and should the larger Uniform Accountancy Act for Oregon, Senate Bill 1049, become bogged down, we would ask that we have the opportunity to come back to Senate Bill 157 and Senate Bill 159 to get those specific provisions, which are to a large extent tying our hands right now.
To be clear, those elements are included also in 1049.
Senate by our members of the committee, they are included in 1049 in a manner that is satisfactory to the State Board of Accountancy.
Thank you. Wes? Could you introduce yourselves to the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roy Rogers. I'm also on the list there. My opening remarks will be on behalf of the Oregon Society, and Les Gordon is sitting beside me. I should have a list. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for hearing this bill. It's an important one to us, and we appreciate the time that you spent today in listening to our remarks. My job will be simply to give you some background, to give you some idea on globally what this bill does and some of the aspects of it. Les's job will be to give you some more of the specifics. Before I get into that, though, I'd like to recognize in the audience with me today Ray Johnson, who's a professor at Portland State. He's the current president of the Oregon Society. We also have Brent Goodfellow, a practitioner from Beaverton. He's the immediate past president of the Oregon Society, and all of about 2 weeks ago they switched offices. Bob Linhausen, who's the past president, he's from Beaverton, Oregon, and he's our legislative chair. We have Mike Lewis, who is he's going to be next year's president of the Oregon Society, and he's from Springfield, Eugene, Oregon. So they're here as well and very supportive. What are we asking of you? We're asking that you support Senate Bill 1049, and I think you need to understand from the outset that what it is a very comprehensive rewrite of the Accountancy Act. And that's simply what it is. It looks ominous maybe in its size, but I think we can dissect that down and give you some ideas to what it's about and why we're proposing it. As you know in your daily lives, and we know in ours, that the world is rapidly changing, and our profession is no different. Things are changing so rapidly that we find that we need flexibility in the regulations, and that's exactly why we're here today, to look at some flexibility. Our membership is changing as well, and we'll tell you today that in our society, as well as the national organization, which is the American Institute, only about 50%, and in fact it's inching below that, of our members practice public accountancy there in every other field that you can think of, barring none, and certainly have a great deal of additional needs for the use of the CPA designation. We're finding that the demand for accounting services and all those peripheral related accounting services are just expanding beyond what you might envision. We'll go through that a little bit. And what that is requiring of us is a whole host of new services. And so, again, the bill, I think, addresses that. And with the ever complexity of changing complexity of our world, we find that we're having to not only relate, but to actually practice with a number of different professional disciplines that you probably can readily think about, but some that you might not as well. And so we're expanding very rapidly into different services, and we need different expertise to do that. What's creating all of this? Other than, as you said, the complexity of the world, well, globalization, those of us, I happen to be from Tigard, Oregon, and we have a number of silicon-based enterprises there in Washington County, and globalization, as you all know, is rapidly changing how we envision the world. State boundaries and even boundaries of countries mean very little today in terms of commerce and how we conduct business. Technology has meant that all of us, whether we're a home-based business or a large firm or a small firm, are able to conduct business around the world, whether it be through the Internet or through other devices. And so technology has meant that we're having to practice in other jurisdictions, and we're having to have some kind of comprehensive look at not only their regulations, but their regulations of us as well. I've mentioned the expansion of services. You probably think of us as doing tax returns, and that's good since the season's just over, but we also do audits and those kinds of additional services, but a whole host of other things, from financial planning to computer technology to pension administration work, all requiring licenses and expertise that accounting firms in the past didn't have. All of that meant that we've had some challenges, and these are legal challenges, not only from outside our profession, but within. restraints of trade are often heard about. Why can't I practice under the CPA designation doing a host of things? This seems permissible around the world. And so we're finding that the legal challenges are facing us even if we didn't want to change, to look at change, and as well as the demographic shifts that I've mentioned, that our members are no longer simply in public practice. They're in every other service and business that you can imagine, and they'd like to take that CPA designation with them as well. I think if we look at the bill and say, well, what are the components, and try to hit the key ones, and I won't spend a lot of time because Les will do that, but just so that you know that it's not as complex as it may appear on the surface, there's four issues that I think that we need to chat about real quickly. One of them is what we call substantial equivalency, which is a large way of saying we'd like to be able to practice across state lines very easily. Our national organizations and the international organizations are attempting to understand with the global economy that we need to be able to practice across state lines and country lines without a great deal of difficulty, and this bill addresses that issue. Non-CPA or PA ownership, we understand, and I'm telling you today, and I think you understand that as well, that because our practices are now dealing with a number of services that we may not have dealt with in the past, the disciplines that are required are not always CPA-designated disciplines. Everyone from actuarial folks to engineers to consultants of a variety of backgrounds. And what they're asking us to do is to own a piece of that business that they're now practicing in. And so we're asking that you consider that as well. The acceptance of commissions and contingent fees, you're going to hear more about that, and I suspect that may be where your questions might lie. I would simply say that 34 states in this great nation of ours have already adopted that particular provision, and with about, you think, only 50 jurisdictions, but you've got a couple others with Guam, Puerto Rico, and I guess another one with the District of Columbia. The 34 of them already adopting, more of them on the way. It's an avalanche of acceptance and a swell of folks across this country who are saying that's a provision that the time has come. And the use of the CPA-PAA designation right now is very narrowly defined. You have to be in practice to be using it. But we're finding that we have folks, again, who, as I mentioned, are in a variety of different kinds of industries, asking that be a transferable kind of credential, that they can use that freely since they have passed a very rigorous examination and licensing requirements. And so that'll be talked about as well. There may be some confusion as to 157 and 159, which I know you're hearing. How does that interface with the particular bill that we're asking you to take a hard look at today? How it relates is that everyone comes with their particular legislative agenda. The State Board of Accountancy has, as you know, asked you to look favorably upon 9 different issues. 7 of them they have passed. 2 of them are before you today, and they interface with our particular bill that we have. We find only minor changes that need to be done for us to find complete agreement with 157 and 159. Pardon me. But I want you to know clearly that indeed we are not at odds at all, and it's simply a matter of timing. One final thing that I would say to you before turning it over to Les, that it's not our intent, and it was never our intent, to have any effect on any non-licensed accountants. That's often something that people are concerned about, or we're somehow regulating people out of a business, or somehow changing their livelihood. That was never the intent. If that is in here, we want to be on record to very clearly say that for our friends who are practicing accountancy as well as tax preparation. This is not intended to be an impact to them at all. Again, thank you very much for your time. I know it's been a long day for you already, and we appreciate very much the opportunity to present our testimony on 1049.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Les Fordham. I'm a practitioner in Hillsboro, Oregon, working for CPA firm Fordham & Fordham. We have 21 employees, to give you an idea, one office, local firm. The reason that we've split up our discussion like this is that you've had now a good overview of the reasons for the bill and the environment that we work in. I have been fortunate in being able to have worked with this bill for over 2 years, starting at the national level in one capacity, and then through the whole process with the Oregon Society of CPAs, with the State Board of Accounts, seeking finally to bring Senate Bill 1049 here. And so I was, I'm going to give you a brief, more detailed description of a couple of the key points that are included in this bill, and then perhaps be able to answer your questions in case you have any other technical questions regarding these issues. So the first item I'd like to point out is that this bill clearly defines what is known as the test services. Now, test services is generally the areas where CPAs provide assurance on financial information. And you may know that as our audits of financial statements, we do reviews of financial statements, and compilations of financial statements, some of which have real high levels of assurance and some very little levels of insurance. But the concept of the test services is very important in the bill because it comes up in a variety of different places as we move through the legislation. The bill also changes regulations regarding the registration of CPA firms. You've heard that it allows non-CPA ownership of firms, but it requires that a firm have a simple majority of owners be licensed CPAs, that those owners be active, and it also requires that all other owners be active participants in the business. And probably the area that you might have the most questions on, commissions and contingent fees, Bill 1049 repeals the prohibition against accepting commissions except where clients for which the firm provides the test services. So again, this concept of the test services works its way back into the bill. What it's saying here is that CPA should be able to charge their clients in any way that the client agrees to pay for their services, except where there's a public interest. And the public interest is defined in this case as where the CPA is offering his assurance on financial statements, financial information, that information being used by the public. It is also a requirement of the bill that the commissions and contingencies may only be received after full disclosure to the client of the fee arrangement. So the client must agree to the fee arrangement. It also aligns the state law with the existing American Institute of Certified Public Accountants Code of Ethics. The Code of Ethics for several years has allowed these types of transactions, and our law has not been aligned with the code from the American Institute. The question comes up, well, will charging commissions be detrimental to the public? Well, we don't believe it is, because if it is not in a test client, if it's not a client for which we're issuing our assurance on their financial information, the public itself does not have a direct interest. I mean, the public does use our financial statements, banks use it, individual stockholders use it, people interested in investing, companies use it. And so the test services are very important, and this bill specifically prohibits any type of commission or contingency arrangement for a CPA to take from that type of a client or a client where we're providing those services. We also have to get full disclosure. So if a client does not want to work under a commission arrangement, then the client can just simply decline to do business on a commission basis. That opens up avenues for people, for clients to make a choice. Do they want it to be a contingency where if they don't have the right kind of success that they don't have to pay anything, or would they rather have an opinion on a fee service? Would they rather have the service prepared for a regular hourly charge like we've been doing in the past? Other professionals provide these similar services, with the expansion of services that Roy was alluding to. Other professionals provide the same types of services on a commission basis, and it levels the playing field on those types of services. Again, we've stated that 34 states have passed similar legislation. I believe your package has a list of those states. And I happen to know, working on the national level, that virtually every other state is currently working to adopt the Uniform Accountancy Act in as many ways as possible because of the substantial equivalency that we're looking for interstate commerce. I'd like to give you a couple of examples where...
Right out there, could you summarize it down pretty quickly?
I'm just going
to... I have another committee coming in at 3 o'clock, and there's some people that also want to testify.
Okay.
And so can you just kind of summarize it down into a quick...
Okay, I'll give you one example where this might apply, just so you have it in perspective. And I'll give you a personal example. Last year, a client came in, he asked me to look at his tax return. When he got done with that, he said, you know, that's not the real reason I came in. I was hoping you'd be able to find someone who could purchase my business. And I work in an association where we have avenues to be able to locate that type of a buyer for this client. And when we started talking about fees, he said, well, I would expect that it would be a commission. If we don't have success, you don't sell my business, then how can I be paying you? That type of a transaction is prohibited under current state law, and with the passage of this law, we would be able to work a fee arrangement with that type of a client for a commission-based success type fee. So those are a few of the technical points that were brought up. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Robert Gordon, Richard Garlick, Joyce Hansen, and Barry Swigert. Swigert, is that right? Okay. Welcome, gentlemen.
Richard Garlick. I'm a practicing public accountant in Portland, Oregon, past president of the National Society of Public Accountants, and I'm also an enrolled agent to practice before the Internal Revenue Service.
We have your written testament here. Could you...
That's right.
...summarize that and...
Well, people that just went before me spoke a lot about the attest function and the compilation and review services. And in my estimation, that is the most damaging part of this bill to the non-certified public accountant.
Can you say that again now?
The compilation and review services section where they make that part of the attest function. The definition of the attest function to include compilation and review is the most damaging section. When compilation and review services first came into being, the purpose was to limit the liability of those practitioners performing such services. The compilation and review services, unlike the audit service, gives no assurance and reliability or fairness to the statement. In today's litigious world, making compilation and review part of the attest function could certainly be detrimental not only to CPAs, but to the non-licensed segment. That, in my estimation, is the most damaging part. Over the past 48 years in the business that I've been in, I've continually seen the CPA group try to close the door, so to speak, on how you come into the profession. And I, for one, feel that there should be a definite route into the accounting profession that isn't so demeaning or detrimental. The 150-hour rule, for instance, that we currently have in our law that was passed, I think, in the last legislature, but is part of this 1049, just makes it that much harder for those to sit for the CPA exam. In order to become a licensed public accountant, you have to sit for the CPA exam and pass even the audit section. But it's a tough world for the non-certified group in the profession, and I feel that before long there won't be that many people even wanting to go into the profession because of the restrictions and regulations that have been placed on it.
Thank you very much, sir.
Chairman Nelson, and the members of the committee, Jeff, members of the staff. I'm a public accountant from Bend, Oregon. I have served 2 3-year terms on the Board of Accountancy. I am a past president of the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. I've served on national committees, having chaired the State Regulatory Oversight Committee for 3 years. May I say that, as such, I'm also an associate member of the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. And it's to my best belief that Oregon already has substantial equivalency without this legislation. And I'm addressing Senate Bill. My testimony only addresses Senate Bill 1049 because I feel that 157 and 159 are an integral part of 1049 already. You have my written testimony before you with attachments. I'm not going to sit here and read that to you, but I do want to point out an article on the back of that attachment, on the back of that testimony, that of Eli Mason, who is a past president of New York State Society of CPAs, etc. It's all listed there as to his qualifications. And I believe the Federal Securities Exchange Commission expressed some concern relative to the passage of the Uniform Accountancy Act as to what effect it would have on independence. And just ahead of that article, I've attached a copy of our existing Oregon administrative rules pertaining to its independence. So, consequently, as indicated by Mr. Mason, they formulated a special committee to address the independence issue called the Independent Standards Board. And it's made up of three of the national CEOs, the president of the American Institute of CPAs, and four public members. And as Mr. Mason will point out in that article, it's kind of like on the first draft, the first statement issued by that board, that the four public members were pretty much led down the primrose path. And I ask that you be very cautious of 1049, that we don't also get led down a primrose path here in Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Joyce Bonkowski, the past president of the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants, and I currently serve as chair of the legislative committee. The main objective of our association is to assure the independent accountants the role in Oregon's accounting profession. With this in mind, in 1997, we sponsored legislation, House Bill 3331, which passed into legislation that year, safe harbor language which allowed the non-licensed accountant to prepare financial statements without using restricted language used by the CPAs. I'm pleased to see this is in this bill. I do find some restrictions, though, or maybe need some clarification, placed on the independent accountant using the word accountant or accredited tax advisor or accredited business accountant. We feel this would be unfair to the independent accountant. The public interest requires affordable accounting be available. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Let's see. We have Barry Swigert. Sure. Here, your testimony would be basically the same as these folks.
Same as
Joyce. Same as Joyce, okay. Smart man. James Aldridge, Barbara Mall, and Charlene Keith. Please? Joyce Loforce. All three of those? Okay, very good. Well, let's see. Then we have one more. Ray Johnson. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. The rest of the committee. My name is Ray Johnson. I'm currently president of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm a professor of accounting at Portland State University. Let me keep my comments brief. I think there are a couple things that need clarification with respect to this bill. The first, with respect to the issue of independence, there is nothing in this bill that would change the current definitions of independence. Accountants would continue to need to be independent any time that they provide assurance on financial statements. With respect to the issue that's been discussed with respect to commissions, accountants would be prohibited from engaging in any kind of work for a commission where they were providing assurance, and that independence would be required. So essentially, we've tried to take great safeguards to preserve all the concepts of independence. Our members respect the fact that we've earned a reputation for high integrity. I think that integrity is integral to this concept of independence, and this bill has been crafted in a way that it, in any way that independence would be expected by the public, it would continue to be preserved as it is today. I'd go on to comment that with respect to the use of the term accountant, on page 13 of the current draft, I'm looking particularly at lines 43, 44, and 45. It says, use of the words accountants or accounting by a person or business offering services that are not restricted to a person or business holding a license or permit. So using that term accountant or accounting is not restricted to somebody holding a license or permit in the state under this bill. So I think that's particularly important that you understand. We've had a variety of conversations throughout the year with the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. We don't want to change their ability to hold themselves out as accountants in any way. There's no change in this bill with respect to an individual's ability to perform compilation and review services. About 20 years ago now, we offered a variety, rather than just having an audit or not an audit. We created, as a profession, a range of assurance that could be provided, particularly for small businesses. This bill would allow exactly the same services that are offered today. Those would be continued, and it wouldn't put any new prohibitions on anybody providing those services. Our members, I'd have to admit that there are probably some of our members that are skeptical about the issue of commissions, but the vast majority and the solid majority of our members have clearly stated that they think that their clients think commissions are important to compete, and we've tried to draft that in a way that commissions would always be fully disclosed up front with the client, as opposed to any hidden commissions that sometimes exist in other types of services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming to testify. Appreciate your just coming down and sitting and for going there. If you want a quick 2 minutes to testify on something, you're certainly welcome to. Maybe you're happy. Close the public hearing, and we'll put this in again. Public hearing, and okay, then open up a work session on Senate Bill 907. Where are we with that? Maybe can you give a quick explanation?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 907 is a bill that has been referred to this committee, but a committee does not have the time to sit in its agenda, so it's been requested by a joint concurrence of the chair of this committee and the chair of the Transportation Committee for 907 to be referred to the Senate Transportation Committee. And if there is a motion for the bill to be moved out of committee, referred to transportation with no recommendation from this committee.
Are you going to work on it, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate Bill 907 be referred to the Committee on Transportation without recommendation from this committee.
Okay, Senator Miller. So move 907 to transportation without recommendation. Any comments? Any objections? So ordered. Any other business before the committee? Adjourned.
Hey, that's a good idea.
It's a great thing about donations.
Yeah.
Well, basically, I did it. It's not going to have any fiscal impact at all. We just,